So come check it out sometime. This is KPFT Houston.
Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals Wednesday, 8 p.m. I'm sorry, Thursday, 8 p.m. We've changed our day. And time for So What's Your Story? We're the only program originating in Houston devoted to live storytelling, and we're right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. I'm Warren Holloman. Tonight I'll be your host. Each week, Hank, Greg, Mary, Tatiana, and I, along with our extended family of guest hosts and guest storytellers. Each week we celebrate the power of story by bringing you remarkable tellers who take us on captivating journeys, and then they bring us safely home. If you were listening last week, you'll know that Greg hosted, and his guest, Ginger Burney of the Houston Heritage Society, and Eric Huffman of the Story Houston, took us on journeys as far away as Peru, and as close to home as Memorial Park, Rice University, and HEB. This week, my guests are going to take us on journeys as far away in space and time as Vietnam of the 1960s, and as close to home as, well, right here in Houston. Born in Riverside, California, Deborah Deep Mouton is an internationally recognized performance poet and the first African-American poet laureate of Houston. Formerly ranked number 2 female performance poet in the world, she's a founding member and executive director of VIP Arts, a nonprofit dedicated to promoting literacy and the arts in underserved populations. Her genre-bending poetry has engendered unconventional collaborations with groups as disparate as the Houston Rockets and the Houston Ballet. Her work has been featured on NPR, the BBC, and the TEDx circuit. Her TEDx talk about being a superwoman, the challenges of trying to be a superwoman, is just amazing, and I'd recommend it to all our listeners. An opera about the life of Marian Anderson, for which she wrote the libretto, premieres at the Houston Grand Opera in the spring of 2020. And as we'll discuss a little later in the show, she's the author of Newsworthy, a book which will be released next month by Bloomsday Literary. My other guest, David F. Brown, was born and raised in the Missouri Ozarks, and he served as a medic with Bravo 14th Infantry in Vietnam, 1969 and 1970. Educated at the University of Missouri and San Francisco State University, he's the author of several books of poetry, Returning Fire, The Other Half of Everything, Assuming Blue, and his latest book, Ghost of a Person Passing in Front of a Flag. His poems have been anthologized in numerous books, including American War Poetry, Carrying the Darkness, and Unaccustomed Mercy. As for his new book, Ghost of a Person Passing in Front of a Flag, published by Bloomsday Literary, the book has received praise from two of the deans of the Vietnam War poetry. John Balaban said, and I quote, D.F. Brown, former medic, assiduous poet, wily storyteller, has written one of the flat-out best books to come out of the Vietnam War. And W.D. Earhart said this, quote, you want to know what war is like? Immerse yourself in these poems. They're brilliant. Deborah, David, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, sir.
I'm so delighted you're here. I have to just off the bat, identity is so important. We talk about that on our show, and our names are important as part of our identity. And I notice each of you have names other than the names your parents gave you, Could you just, in a word, say what your other names mean? Deborah, yeah. You want to go first?
Yeah, I can. So Deborah Deep Mouton is the name that I write under. Deep actually came from my background as a performance poet, and I kind of have a stage moniker that means destined to excel in everything purposed or everything promised. Just depends on the day which one you get. But the idea that God destined and promised and made me for certain things, and those are the ones that I kind of want to be successful at.
Cool.
David?
When I was growing up, my grandfather was David Brown, and I don't know how, but they called me by my initials, D.F., and that's how I've been published since. I think when I was in San Francisco in 84, when the first book was published, I don't remember a clear reckoning about it, but when a publisher said, when I told them I'd like D.F., thinking, of course, all those hillbillies in southern Missouri would just dash right out and buy that book of poems.
So, David, your personal story goes back to the 1960s, a very turbulent time. Today, 50 years later, that turbulence is still felt by many who served in the Vietnam War. Tell us your story.
Well, it's so many stories. The one or two I'd like to relate tonight are about Vietnam. And I finished at the University of Missouri in 1968, and I was headed to the draft and thought I'd better join the Army. All of my uncles, two of my aunts had served in World War II. But I knew the war was wrong. Even in the Ozarks, even in 1968, it smelled bad. And so I joined to be a medic, thinking that would assuage my moral complicity with what was really a bad war. So I went, joined the Army, came down to Texas for the first time in San Antonio for medics training, went to San Francisco, got another year's training. Then I went to Vietnam expecting to be, because of all this training, working in an Army hospital there. Much to my surprise, I was assigned to an infantry battalion. When I arrived at the battalion, and they convinced me it wasn't a mistake, they asked me if I would relieve another medic who was in the field who was getting ready to go home. And I'm not quite sure why I did, because with my training, I wasn't authorized to go to the field. But I suppose some kind of macho thing. I said, sure, I'll do that. How could you say no to your new boss? And I went out with the 1st Platoon of Bravo Company. And I'd been in a hospital for a year, and then suddenly I'm carrying everything medical on my back, and a rifle and a pistol, and walking around the jungle. And I was hand carried for the first few days, but it seemed that the platoon leader was, well, I just thought he was weird, but I was too new to say the lieutenant's weird. But several occurrences that almost got us killed, including his misadventure calling in artillery on top of us, trying to bomb Vietnamese, he ended up bombing us, and our platoon sergeant grabbed the radio and stopped the artillery fire, and I realized that my intuition about his weirdness, his whimpering, was true. And so they took him away quietly and brought us a new lieutenant, and I have now seen one bad lieutenant and was expecting more trouble. And this guy came in to take over my platoon, and was very affable, and the first thing he did that impressed me was talk to our platoon sergeant and say, I'll follow you. You tell me until I get a grip on stuff what you want to do. And I hope, can imagine the relief we all felt, because the other guy was a bad trip. And so I humped the jungle with this guy for 7 more months. He got wounded and left. years later, I left the Army to go to poetry school, and then they invented something called Google. And after three books and talking and lecturing on war in various places, I started Googling people's names. I had this huge desire to catch up with people who I really feel like saved my life on a couple of occasions. And after 10 years of Googling, and this guy has a very common name like mine, I got I mean, 80,000 hits every winter break from school. And I finally got one that looked reasonable. So, and the oddest thing of all, this had an address for the guy. So I wrote him a letter and said, "You may be the guy who led my platoon in the 14th Infantry. You may not want to read this letter. You may not want to talk about it, and that's okay. But if you want to talk, here's my address, my phone number, and my email." And then a couple of days after Christmas in 2013, I got a call from him. And it was, I mean, reunion captures some of it, but this brotherhood, which I didn't really understand until I caught up with this guy, knocked me on my keister. And then it turns out very shortly after that, he was flying with his wife through Houston, had a long layover on their way to Florida. And my wife and I went out and met him at the airport, and we really, I don't know, just looked at each other. It's so unreal. And so after 30 years at that point, and then, a year later, I was reading at Haverford College in Pennsylvania, and he showed up there from where he lived on the West Coast with a couple of three other people, and we had this mini reunion. And then I guess we went out to Arizona and met them at near Four Corners, and it's just been, it was, I think, profoundly comforting to know that he got through okay. I mean, he lost the tip of one of his fingers, I believe. And that he was psychologically intact, and that he had a good life, because so many of the guys I were with, they didn't get through it, or they had issues after the war that made life miserable.
Hmm. Are there others out there that you and the lieutenant would like to find?
Oh, well, we'd love to find that platoon sergeant, Staff Sergeant John Ford. Oddly enough, in 2008, I was the HISD's Secondary Teacher of the Year, and I got a call a month after I got the award, and it was my forward artillery observer. And I went, "My God, how did you find me?" He said, "Oh, his daughter was a teacher, and there was something in the national magazine, and he just took a chance." And I went, "But my phone number is unlisted. How did you get, were you able to call me?" He said, "Oh, yeah, when I left the Army, I've been in the FBI for 40 years, so we can get anything we want."
So what was it like for the lieutenant to be found?
Oh, we were crying. We just, I mean, there wasn't enough Kleenex in the whole world at that point. It was, I think nobody had looked him up, number one. And he was very pleased because all of the, criminal stuff about Vietnam, all of the bad stuff, My Lai wasn't an exception. It was the regular business of Vietnam. It was something that we as veterans often get blamed for. So to find him, and then he was pleased. Mm-hmm. He was greatly pleased. And then it also turned out he's a really wonderful guy. So mm-hmm. that helped a lot. When I read in Philadelphia in 16 or 15, he had set up, so another medic was there, one of the squad leaders, and this forward observer. And we just basically sat around and looked at each other and, you know, talked about the dead.
Hmm. Now, I know you publish primarily as a poet. Do you have a poem or some poems that would serve as an epilogue to this story that you could share with our listeners?
You know, just ask the right questions, Warren. I appreciate that. I think this is from the Bloomsday book, which is called Ghost of a Person Passing in Front of the Flag, and it's kind of the heart of the book. And it starts with a poem called Reality Television, 1969. I thought I knew the way through words to tell. Again, the soldiers take how language harbors expectations, and not just the wasteful carnage of youthful courage cut down for a culture that needs their blood to purpose what little poetry can be made of their passing. What marks those boys slaughtered? They were sent, like you flush the toilet, to a war no one wanted anymore. So they gave it to their children, let them play with death, watch them die on TV during supper. The second one is called What Love Makes of Us. And what I discovered in Philadelphia with those five guys, it was really the most profound love. And my wife completely understands. She's the daughter of a World War II veteran. What Love Makes of Us. I was somewhere again, between history and a hard place, when my wife notices the far away, tosses her comment 10,000 miles, down spans the ocean to reach my heart, and down there in the wind, I thought I could wait it out, let the war go dust and blow away, like Oklahoma in April of 1935. She could hear clouds scrape through the dark. I'll just do two more. This is called Tough Love. I thought I'd put those boys to bed, settled in their hometown soil, beyond the slights and slanders that their service earned them. But now the living cannot let them go. Over and over, they try so hard to make home matter. Parades and banners, billboards and bumper stickers. Welcome home, heroes. The place is sick with flags. And this is a new poem that's not in the book. It's called Karma. It's always, for me, I think, the most amazing things that Americans are surprised about, the violence that strikes inside our country. But, like, you could deliver so much violence to the world and not have it find its way. Karma. When I saw those planes fly one by one into the towers, I thought first the NOM had found its way home, and all the brutal destruction and death America visited on that tiny agricultural nation had soaked through and finally seeped into the backyard for a visit and killed our kids again.
If you're just tuning in, this is So What's Your Story on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. I'm Warren Holloman here with storytellers David Brown and Deborah Mouton. The story David just told began on a battlefield in Vietnam and came full circle back here in the USA. Deborah, your story begins a little closer to home, but it's a journey nevertheless. Could you share with us your story?
Absolutely. For me, just thinking about what story means, kind of brought to bringing myself to Houston. I actually was born in Riverside, California, and grew up in Moreno Valley in Paris, California. And then I went to University of Michigan for college. And when I was getting ready to graduate, I started really thinking about what I wanted to do with my life, which I think all people do when they're getting ready to graduate. And I found myself in love with working with kids, and I knew I wanted to teach. So I applied to be a Teach for America fellow and was quickly denied of that position. But by the time I was done with the application, I was absolutely in love with the idea of coming to Houston. I'd never been here before, but I felt like God was really leading me just to try something new. And so I went back home and tried to start thinking of a plan of what I was going to do to get to Houston. And I started looking into alternative certification programs. I found one with Region 4 that I really loved, and it felt like a good fit. But the problem was that I had to pass a test that I had never passed before to get into the program. And the test had to be taken in Houston, of course. And I lived in, you know, near LA and didn't know what I was going to do. And so I got to the day, probably about a week before the test, they told me that there were no spots available. That they might have some standby spots, but I would have to drive down to Houston and wait and just see. And that was an expensive trip, right, to be able to pack everything up and kind of just drive down to Houston and hope. And I prayed about it, and I felt like God was just telling me that if I wanted something different, I had to do something different. And so my mother and I, we drove 23 straight hours from California to Houston just in time to find that they had one spot that opened up that morning for me to take the test. And I sat and thought about it, and I was like, you know, Lord, if this is really what you want me to do, then I have to pass this test the first time because I'm not coming back for this. You know, it's got to be easy. And by the skin of my teeth, I passed the test. So I started thinking about when I was really going to move down to Houston, and the program kept being delayed. And I was laying in my bed one morning and I heard this audible noise. It sounded of my dad's voice come in the room and just say the word November. And when I got up and checked to see where my father was, he had been long gone at some retreat, never been there that morning. But this voice kept lingering with me. And so I kind of came to the decision I was either going to pack up on, you know, all of my faith and jump into Houston, or I was going to sit and in my parents' home and wonder what, you know, what to do after college. And so I decided to leap, and I packed up all my stuff and put it in a U-Haul, and my family drove me down to Houston. We stayed in a hotel. I lined up some job interviews. You know, I thought it was going to be a pretty easy transition. You know, my brand new degree was supposed to guarantee me something, right? And after about 15 job interviews, and I normally interview really, really well. You know, if I get an interview, I'm pretty much guaranteed the job. But after about 15 interviews, I was still with no prospects. And it came to a time where the money that I had paid for the hotel had kind of been used up, and my family's sick time had been used up. And the choice was that they were either going to take me back to California, or that they were going to leave me here with no job, nowhere to live, you know, and a car payment that I could get a new car if I wanted to, but I had no job to sustain it. And I just looked around and I decided that I was going to stay. And I remember my parents and my brother and his wife pulling out of the hotel and them looking out the back window of the car. And I remember thinking, I have to smile, because they'll freak out if I don't smile. And thinking, I have no idea what I'm going to do. I got in a car, but outside of that, you know, all my belongings were kind of living in the car with me. And I knew the money that I had for the hotel was going to run out soon. So I started hitting the pavement, just applying for jobs. And I did that for about a week and a half before I realized that if I kept living in a hotel, that all the money that I had for a down payment on an apartment was going to dwindle quickly. So my dad had befriended the hotel manager, as he befriends everyone, because that's who my father is. And I went to the manager and I told him I was getting ready to check out one night. And he looked at me and he said, why? And I was like, well, if I stay here, I can't afford to live, you know, after this. I don't have a job and I'm still looking in. He said to me, how much can you pay? And I remember thinking, this hotel room is like $140 a night. You know, we got a room big enough for four of us or five of us, and had a little kitchenette and everything. You know, it was an expensive hotel room. And he said, just how much can you pay? And I said, well, you know, maybe if you bring it down to 100, I could do a couple more nights, buy myself a little time. So he said, okay. And I kept interviewing and kept coming up with nothing. And, you know, a few days later, I was like, hey, I'm getting ready to move out. I don't know what I'm going to do. And he said, well, how much can you pay? And I just remember thinking, you know, what kind of compassion is this that you don't know me? You know, you made friends with my father one time for 2 days, and now for some reason you're willing to have this grace with me. And I remember saying, like, I can only pay like $40 a night. And he said, that's fine. That's fine. Just don't tell anyone. And a couple more days passed by, and I came down, and I, you know, this time I'm very committed to leaving, right? I'm like, there's just no way we can keep doing this. And he said, if I do it for $25 a night, can you stay a couple more nights? And I said, okay, sure. And he said, well, if you do, I may have a position waiting for you at my friend desk, and we'll just hire you and we'll pay you a little bit to stay afloat, you know, until you find something else. You could work nights so you could find another job, and you could just work and live here for a little while. And I later found out that my father had asked him to watch over me while he was gone. And there's something about that bond between them, just in those few days, that you know, charge him with this responsibility for me in a way that I am so indebted for the rest of my life. And so I stayed for a little while. And the day I was supposed to sign my contract to begin working for the hotel was sold and the owners no longer had the ability to give me a job. And so I found myself living in my car, right? Kind of packed up all my belongings that morning. And I was interviewing and I didn't know what I was going to do. I was going to so many jobs that if one of them had called me and offered me one, I would not have known what job I was getting. And I got down to my last little bit of money. And I told God, you know, the choice was to put more gas in my car or to eat. And I decided to eat. You know, I was like, you know, at the end of the day, I have to live. And so I went to CC's Pizza, and my idea was that I was going to package as much pizza into my purse as possible, right? It's going to take all the breadsticks, everything. And as I was opening the door to get out of the car, my phone rang, and it was a job offer for $100 less than I needed to qualify for my apartment. And I remember just crying, you know, just utterly weeping at the grace of God and at such provision. And I was like, you know, I can sleep in my car for a week. The apartment wasn't going to be ready. I was like, I can make it. And a friend of a friend of a friend that had never met me before who lived here in Houston calls my father and told her if I can meet her, she had a bedroom for me in a back room. And that family is still friends of mine to this day. They held me and they took care of me. They fed me. They made sure I was safe and sound for a week until my apartment was ready. And when I moved in, I remember laying on the floor and how soft the carpet was and just remembering, like, this is what it feels like to be home, to be loved this way in a way that I will never understand or imagine.
That's incredible. That's a testimony to our city, but it's also a testimony to your perseverance, your bravery, your courage.
At the time, it didn't seem brave. It just seemed kind of reckless. But, you know, I'm grateful for every moment of it.
We were talking before the show, and I was saying how I lived in another city before I came to Houston, and how I never felt I was a part of that city. And immediately when I came to Houston, I felt welcomed in so many ways.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I ran into the same thing, whether it's from the food or from, you know, just someone willing to wave hello to you. Or, you know, I've found myself in a situation where I've been homeless 3 times, you know, since I've been in Houston. And every time, you know, people have stepped in to do something for me that was unheard of, that was, you know, unexplainable, to move my life and shift my life in ways that have kept me until I was able to get on my feet. And now, you know, being much more established, it's just astonishes me. And I'm now always looking for ways that I can be that for other people.
As a poet laureate of Houston, you're kind of an ambassador for our city.
Yeah.
And I've seen your video about Hurricane Harvey and your story poem.
Absolutely.
About the resilience of this city.
Yeah.
And even the Houston Rockets video gets into the resilience, that theme.
Yes.
Of, thank you for taking your personal story and making it the story of all of us in some sense. I think we can all identify with that.
Absolutely. I especially think with Hurricane Harvey, we had this greater renewal of understanding what community looked like and how to step in for each other and how to put aside all the things that may make us different and just get to the humanity and the heart of ourselves. And so I hope that Houston continues to show that and continues to figure out a way to hold each other up.
What would you like our listeners to take from your story?
I think that it takes crazy things to get crazy results, right? That that God definitely has a plan, that leaps of faith are often met with the largest and most abundant bouts of joy if you stick with them, you know, that perseverance is the only way to get anywhere. You know, I think all of those things are valuable lessons that we have to learn. And once we apply them in our lives, I think that's when we really start living. Because just being on this earth is not much fun, but when you start living, that's something different.
And one thing I took from your story is this: the way you told it. I mean, we look up to you as the, quote, the poet laureate of Houston, and you've won all of these honors and awards, which are you're very deserving of. And
well,
yet
thank
in your story, you're very vulnerable, and you talk about a time when you were most people did not know who you were.
Absolutely. No one knew. No one knew.
Not every storyteller can do that. Some people think a good story is a story where you brag about what you achieved.
Yeah.
And you've done the opposite. You've shown a gratitude and humility that and vulnerability. Does that come? Where does that come from for you?
I mean, you know, I grew up with as a child of two pastors, you know.
Oh, so that's, okay.
There's definitely that in there. But I think more than anything, you know, I've experienced enough low in my life that I realize that high is a pleasure and a privilege, mm-hmm. and it's not a guarantee. And so I think for me, it's just staying grounded and realizing that at any moment, any of us, what, are one paycheck away from being homeless, or one paycheck or one hurricane away from losing everything. I think when we stay in that space, we can understand each other better, you know. Titles and awards and all those things are great and wonderful, and they also really fade away and they expire. And at the end of the day, we have to be who we are, and we have to be the people we are. And so, you know, none of those things have changed me. I still realize that, you know, I'm just a person.
Good. Well, when I watch your YouTube videos, I realize you're the person that's on those videos. And I think that's a very refreshing thing that we can all relate to.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope so. Mm-hmm.
So this is Warren Holloman. I'm here with Tatiana Gago running the control board, as always. Tonight you're enjoying stories from our guest tellers David Brown and Deborah Deep Mouton on So What's Your Story, 90.1 KPFT Houston. You can catch us at 89.5 in Galveston and 91.9 in Huntsville. I'm going to give Deborah and David a chance to catch their breath while we tell our listeners what's coming up with the Houston Storytelling Calendar. Tatiana?
A big thank you, as always, to our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. The Guild hosts a story swap every fourth Tuesday of the month at Temple Emmanuel across from Rice University. Also, check the Guild's event page for other storytelling activities around the Houston area. There, you'll learn about the annual Houston Liars Contest coming on Saturday, April 13th at Houston Baptist University. Our very own Dr. Hank Rubicek will be hosting the event, right? Liar, liar, pants on fire?
Yes. The reason why I'm hosting is because they told me to. That's the truth. Yeah, nobody else wants to do it, so I'm going
to
do it.
And leave it to Hank to run a liar's contest at a Baptist university.
Isn't that the truth? Yes. The liar's contest is a lot of fun. Mary is going to be hosting a show week after next, and Tatiana's going to talk about her program next week. But Mary is going to be having a couple of liars on the air, very wonderful, talented people. And these are really people who create the tall tale, and it's their stock and trade. And these are magnificently, wonderfully funny stories, which have just that little hint of plausibility that makes them even more interesting. I came in third a couple of years ago, but I think there were only three people competing. I don't know. So I think that was the only choice.
And that's a lie. You were really fourth.
Right. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. But, we are looking forward to that. And I'm enjoying the show. You know, I came in a little bit late, so you'll have to forgive me if I'm repeating myself or if you guys already spoke about this. But, you know, the poet laureate, this whole notion that people don't realize the power of a poet laureate. I mean, we're talking about a person who celebrates Houston rich culture and diversity through the work of poetry. And poetry is meaning beyond facts. Is that fair? It's meaning beyond facts.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it fosters a kind of empathy that is so unique to this city. So I'm so wonderfully thrilled that you're here.
Well, thank you
and
for having me.
These are wonderful. Really, really wonderful. So we're talking about lying and empathy all in the same sentence. Thank you for the chance of doing that, Mark.
And by the way, Deborah's poems, I've listened. They're really stories. They're narrative poems.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So no, they are
they're
definitely
perfect for our listeners. Tatiana?
And while you're there on the Houston Storytellers Guild website, check out their archive of all of our previous shows, nearly 500 of them. Just click on the radio programs tab and you'll be in story heaven.
So that's the Houston Storytellers Guild. What's going on at the Moth?
The next Houston Moth Story Slam is coming up on Tuesday, April 16th. The theme will be bamboozled. And in case you're 60 years old or under and you haven't heard the word bamboozled, it's stories about being naive, being fooled, and being deceived. Everything from April Fool pranks to internet scams, smooth talking, bad acting boyfriends, and girlfriends.
So as long
as we have to brag for a moment, and the reason why Tatiana is bragging and the reason why she's sounding so interesting and so intelligent college, and it was because she was just accepted to graduate school at the University of St. Thomas. So
Wait.
Now she's really demonstrating her intellect.
That's a
showing off.
Congratulations. I literally, like an hour ago, you found out?
Yeah, yes, I did. During the interview process, I was told in the middle of it, oh, by the way, you have been admitted. Like, oh, well, thank you.
So last week, you missed the show because
yes.
you were being inducted into the Honor Society.
Yes, Phi Kappa Phi. I found out I'm graduating as top 10% of my class.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you.
That's really...
I'm kind of smart.
Big deal. Way to go.
Thank you.
I hope we'll be able to keep you here once you...
I'm not going anywhere,
okay,
I promise.
Good. So what I learned from that is about the bamboozled, though, is that if you don't use the internet and you don't have any boyfriends or girlfriends, you'll never be bamboozled, so you'll be okay. Is that right?
Yeah, you won't be bamboozled. You'll just be lonely and bored.
So that our listeners will not feel bamboozled about our show, would you share with our listeners the amazing guest host we have scheduled for next week and what she has planned for the show?
Well, I will be bringing a mixed bag of stories from University of Houston downtown students and alums. We're going to have Vanessa Ramirez, Sierra Lawson, Madeline Leonard, Cam Living, and Rosie Williams. And also a reminder, whether it's next week's show or any of our other shows, you don't need a radio to listen to us. You can listen to us online at www.kpft.org. And you can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, finding more and more ways to bring you engaging stories from passionate storytellers. Warren.
And I'm here with two passionate and master storytellers, I would add, poets David or D.F. Brown, and Deborah Deep Mouton. They both have new books that have just come out, and I want to give them, not only congratulate them on the air, but give them a chance to tell our listeners about their books and where they can get a copy. David, you want to go first?
Sure. And again, congratulations, Tatiana. That's a wonderful accomplishment. Graduate school is always the best time of your life.
I agree. Well,
a couple years ago, I won a prize, 4 years ago, from the University of Iowa, the Iowa Review, selected a sequence of poems I wrote, won second place in a Jeffrey Sherratt Memorial Prize. And I was given a reading at the Brazos Bookstore, and a friend of mine, Mark Dostert, brought his friend, Fook Liu, to hear me. As I was reading the poems, I mentioned Quy Nhon, a coastal town in Vietnam, where Phu had been born. Born while I was out in the county shooting at his cousins. We hit it off right away. And shortly after that, he brought Kate Martin Williams over and said, "We're starting a new independent small press in Houston, and we think we want your book for the debut publication." And first of all, I was excited about having a new press in Houston. 6 million people, there ought to be 24 independent literary presses in this town. And theirs makes, I think, the fourth. I'm not sure who's still in business. Mm-hmm. But their whole purpose in this was to expand both in terms of diversity, but in terms of building audiences for literature in Houston. And so my experience with them was incredible. Fu came over to my house one afternoon. I showed him a Randy Twaddle graphite on paper picture I had, and I said, "I'd like that to be the cover." And he took a photo of it, put it on his computer, and in a matter of minutes had 85% of the cover that we went to press with. And they've just been so, they reminded me of the people Deborah was talking about, who stepped in with a kind of grace and helped bring my baby, which is, it's not a happy book, but it is a true book. And I've been published on the West Coast and on the East Coast, and being published in my new hometown was really an honor for me.
That's cool. I know I've ordered a copy. And
you can order it from Amazon. You can get it straight from Bloomsday Literary. And just go to bloomsdayliterary.com. You can also go to D.F. Brown, capital D period, capital F period, brown.com, and you can order it there or pick up a link. And I think that's the way. Brazos Bookstore had some. The Menil Collection Bookstore had some. River Oaks Bookstore has some. Oh, they did. Mm-hmm. I haven't been in this week.
That's great. Congratulations.
Ah, thank mm-hmm. you.
Deborah?
Yeah, so it's going to sound like a similar story over here, since DF is my publisher brother at Bloomsday Literary. I actually met them doing the F and Shakespeare podcast, which they host. And so for me, I came on and was able to kind of just talk about my work and work on stage. And from there, they asked me, did I have a book? And it's kind of been one of the things I've wanted to do. And so talked over it for a little while and realized that they were just some really great people to start with. And they've been great. The editing has been wonderful. And I've learned so much in the process. And so thanks to Kate and Foo for that. And my book is also available at bloomsdayliterary.com. Or you can go to my website, which is livelifedeep.com. Social media is all at Live Life Deep as well, if you want to follow me for upcoming events.
Or they can go to your book launch.
Yes, I was just about to say that. See?
Yeah.
And the book launch will be taking place April 20th at the University of Houston downtown. It's hosted by their English department and their cultural enrichment program, as well as Bloomsday Literary, and we'll be having a really great show. It's going to include myself, a few other poets in the community, and Urban Souls dance team. So we'll have a little bit of a performance with some of the work, and I'm just really excited to kind of give this work to Houston.
Cool. I'm planning to be there.
Yeah, I hope to
I've already signed up for it. And I'm guessing Hank and Tatiana might be there too, since that's their campus.
I would love that.
Yeah. So, Deborah, back to stories. Telling stories.
Yes.
Not writing them. In the first story you told was about your own personal journey. And your second story, I understand, is about your brother and about a scary situation that happened when he was young.
Yeah.
Could you share that? And I also believe this story is in some ways the seed of the book you just described.
Absolutely. So this is a huge part of the narrative and the motivation behind Newsworthy.
So could you share that story with our listeners, or part of it? Don't do the whole thing or they might not buy the book.
Absolutely. I got it. In high school, I found myself in class like normal. You know, my parents would often take us out to do long weekends at Magic Mountain, you know, have some fun with the family. And I remember being called out this day, and I didn't really understand what was happening, but my mother seemed very frantic. And she told me before we left the building that my brother had been arrested. And I remember thinking, huh? I don't understand. I mean, he had definitely not been home for a couple days, but he was a teenager and he was with friends, and that seemed like it was always a normal thing. And I found out later that this night my brother was on his way home from my sister's house in Compton and decided that he didn't want to get dressed because he was driving in the middle of the night. So he just kind of threw on a t-shirt and boxers and got in the car. And I guess he was just really tired. And on the way home, he began to swerve a little bit here and there just from the exhaustion. Before long, the police saw him swerving and pulled him over. Little did we know that there was a man with an alias to his, just a slight middle name difference, that was wanted for armed robbery, Grand Theft Auto, and a few other charges that were kind of really, really large and pending. And without any kind of provocation, they decided to add my brother's name to the list of aliases and arrest him. He sat in jail for a night before he was able to reach my mother through a mutual friend. And my mother, when she came to get me, was kind of frantically running towards the jail. We got to LA and my mom dropped me off at my grandmother's house. And I remember asking her if I could go with her and her insisting that I stay. Before long, she returned back in tears. I could tell that my mother had been crying, and my mother doesn't cry often. But she had spent the last few hours at the jail insisting that they run my brother's fingerprints, which they hadn't done, that they just listen and realize that he was a 16-year-old boy, not this monster that they painted him out to be. But unfortunately, on a Thursday and Friday, getting processed in a prison, that means you have to sit the entire weekend. And so they shipped him to a maximum security prison where he was in general population, and he sat out the weekend while my mother tried and begged for them to run his fingerprints.
How old was he?
He was 16. Wow. And I remember the kind of helplessness that my mother sat in my mother's face. And I remember even my own helplessness. You know, my father was away on a retreat at the time, and he just couldn't seem to get back fast enough. My mother just begged and couldn't find anything else to do. And by the next weekend, you know, by the time the next week started, she found herself back at the jail, this time with me, begging and pleading for them to let him go. And they told her that she would have to wait on his arraignment. So I remember walking into the courtroom, and I remember sitting in the back. And before I knew it, my brother appeared in an orange jumpsuit and handcuffs, shackles around his ankles. And I remember thinking my brother was always a knucklehead. You know, he was always in a little bit of trouble, but it was never this bad. And he turned and looked at me and then quickly cowered away. And I remember the shame that sat in his face for something that he hadn't done. But he was so ashamed to be in this position. And the judge, you know, the lawyers came before the judge, and they asked what he pled, and he pled innocent. And without a moment's notice, he was freed, right? There was no conversation about it, but there was also no apology for the fact that he had sat in a maximum security prison for 7 days. Mm. And this kid, right, wasn't a kid anymore. And I remember him coming out of that and us going to eat, and the way that he reacted to the people around him, and the way that he scarfed food down his mouth because he had waited to eat a real meal, and the way that he shivered when people opened the door. And I'll never forget kind of that fear and the learning from that fear of all the things to be afraid of, how to be afraid of yourself, how to be afraid of who you could be, how to be afraid of how people can perceive you. And I think that's something that's always stuck with me. You know, I tried to go into law at one point in time just because I feel like there has to be a voice for it. But the more that I, dove into that, the more I figured that the best way to combat this kind of ignorance and this kind of fear is to talk about it and to show that there are people who may look like people that you're afraid of that are just human and relatable and are just kids. Mm-hmm. And so that experience with my brother, it absolutely taught me, one, what it's like to be a Black person in America in a real way, but two, that there are times where the system will just sweep you up, and if you don't have the kind of people that are willing to beg for your freedom, the kind of people who are willing to say something and speak out, then what would this world be like?
What, if I may ask, and you don't have to answer this.
You're fine.
What was the emotional impact on your brother?
You know, he never was in trouble again, as far as mm-hmm. big trouble, but from there he just was never the kind of lighthearted kid he was again. Mm-hmm. You know, everything he looked at with this idea that it could always lead him back to jail, you know. And I guess that was a good thing as far as him staying out of trouble, but there was a certain fear that I've never seen go away out of my brother when it comes to his dealings with the police, when it comes to being in the wrong place at the wrong time. He's very cautious, and I think that caution at time has prohibited him from really reaching out mm-hmm. just because of the fear of what it could be perceived as.
So you said that in that instant he went from being a child to being a man, kind
absolutely.
Of.
Absolutely.
And that wasn't entirely a good thing. It was sort of a loss of...
Oh, absolutely.
Some innocence or... But you did not use words like bitterness and anger, and I'm almost a little surprised.
I think there's inherently a bit of anger, but I think when people think about oppression and when people think about, you know, our publisher Fu always says to me, if I was a Black person, I'd wake up every day angry, right? Mm-hmm. And I think there's a certain amount of anger, but so much of it has been kind of beaten in us for such so long of a time that we've accepted things that shouldn't be normal as normal mm-hmm. and that we're getting to a place now where we're beginning to talk about them as not normal things. I think that my brother always heard threats of the police. Mm-hmm. You know, I think my brother always knew that there was a possibility, mm-hmm. but when it's you, I think it's a very different understanding.
Mm-hmm. How many years ago was that?
Oh goodness. This was almost 25 years.
Oh, okay.
You know, he was 16. I was 12 at the time. Mm-hmm. So, no, 20 years. 20 years ago. 22 years ago.
Again, you don't have to answer this, but yeah. Is this something you're... So you've spoken about it very articulately.
Oh, thank you.
And very insightfully. Does your brother talk about it?
Never. Never. And when I sat down to write this book, you know, I reached out to him and I said, I want you to know that I'm referencing mm-hmm. this. I want to know if you're okay with this. And he was like, yeah, just you write the stuff. You know, like, I'm all down with that. But for conversations with my brother, you know, in very rare situations will he really talk about it. But in most, he just kind of shies away from the event. You know, I think he just doesn't want to, he doesn't want to dive back into what those feelings were and those fears were. But I've been in the car with my brother since and stopped by the police, and I see the immediate difference and the fear come back to my brother. And I don't think that'll ever leave.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to extrapolate too much.
Oh, but, you're fine.
I'm still remembering the story David told mm-hmm. a few minutes ago, and I have many friends who are veterans, and we talk about PTSD
oh, yeah.
and anxiety and just different defense mechanisms mm-hmm. people use to cope with painful situations. And I'm seeing a connection
oh, yeah.
to from a, being a soldier in Vietnam to being a teenager in Los Angeles.
Absolutely. And I don't think it's just a Los Angeles thing. You know, a lot of what this book covers is talking about how the black body interacts with, you know, the police mm-hmm. and how the news reports those things, because mm-hmm. I think all of those are layered in our understanding. I think there's always this conversation around why are black people so angry? What the reality is we're not angry on day one or week five or year two, but after 20 years of living a life where you see injustice after injustice and oppression after oppression, like, wouldn't you be angry, you know? Mm-hmm. And so just really diving into the human part of it that says, you know, there's only so much before you say something. There's only so much before you react. And what is that reaction, and how can we make it one where we're now starting a conversation instead of starting a riot?
Yeah. Well, it's been my pleasure to meet you and hear your stories.
Absolutely. Thank you for
person,
having me.
Not just on the internet.
Well, thank you for having me.
But I'm kind of hogging the show here, and I'm going to ask David
Absolutely.
And Tatiana and Hank if they have any comments or questions they'd like to add to your story or David's story.
Well, we're getting Dr. Hank right now at this moment, but I want to say, Deborah, your story, the first story that you told, that took a lot of courage.
Oh,
and living
you.
Living in your car, no, that, you know, that's something that I really do respect, like how hard you work to get where you are right now.
Thank you. Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
And congratulations. I think you kind of stormed out. I'm actually a UST alum, so
oh,
congratulations.
Awesome. Thank you.
Welcome.
Oh, that's awesome. Got a fellow colleague.
Yeah, right absolutely.
Dr. Hank, you got something? Got comments mm-hmm. about the show? He's coming.
Well,
I was out there talking to our friend Harwood Taylor because I have some cards for him. You know, one of the things, Deborah, I'm going to ask you to contact me at school because I want to get you on a UHDI radio.
Absolutely.
When are you going to be on campus?
So the 20th is the book launch.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll be there at 6:30 in the evening at the Robertson Auditorium.
And what day of the week is that?
So it is a Saturday night.
It's a Saturday night. Okay.
Saturday
Who's sponsoring?
Night. It's going to be the English Department and the Cultural Enrichments Program.
Okay. Beautiful, beautiful. Well, we have an internet radio station, and I was telling Tatiana we've got to find a way to get you on here because
Absolutely.
That would be a great idea.
You can do some
idea.
Instagram Live.
Do,
I
yeah,
would love
we
get
don't
that.
Do
get
the broadcasting
them to do that
on Saturday, but you're available during the week, I would imagine.
Absolutely,
and we're going to do that because
get her on
this
air.
Was a very, you know, yeah, you know, the department last year, Davidson. What's your first name? Was the poet laureate
Robin Davidson?
Robin Davidson.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Anytime.
And yeah, we wanted to get her on the air, but she was stage fright, believe
Ooh.
It or not. Mike fright. She said she wanted to be on the radio.
Interesting.
So I'm so glad that you're here. Poetry is one of the best kept secrets. You know, when people think about poetry, they think this is strange. This is vague. This is not profound. It's confusing me. Get it away from me. People
right.
are terrified of it. And you give it just that very applicable topspin, which I think we appreciate. There are things that can be said through poetry that can't be said through other methods,
Absolutely.
Other channels. And I know that's not a very profound thought, but you made that very clear here, and I appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
And I know David was trying to get in. I'm going to...
I was just thinking, and now I've forgotten something that Hank said about poetry that I'm not sure I agree with. Poetry, even at a time when it was published on every page of every American newspaper, which is in my 71-year lifetime, and at a time when there was huge romantic notions about the South and various things, poetry was all over the place. And it's only, I don't know, since the advent of testing, massive testing on school kids, that poetry's gotten such a bad rap. I mean, poetry is like, well, Linda Gregg thinks poetry is fishing in the air. And
no, actually, I agree with you. No, I think that that's, I think you're absolutely right. I think that, I know that poetry historically has been around all over the place. It's kind of like opera. Warren has brought some really magnificent opera specialists on the air. And opera is, you know, it's street entertainment. It isn't anything really special. And I think we've made it so sophisticated, and it's been so... It's been made so magical and almost untouchable.
I think those are synonyms for expensive.
Yeah. Correct.
That too. They made opera expensive.
Correct.
That too. Although your books, I understand, are just really expensive, aren't they? They should be.
I don't know that our books are very expensive. Yeah. I think they're very reasonable.
I think it's reasonable.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, $16 bucks in a market that's usually 25 to 35.
But you're right. But you are right. You know, with the advent of testing, suddenly poetry has become, I don't know what the word is, but it's I write poetry myself, and I love it because it gives me a channel that I really couldn't find elsewhere with certain messages. It just is something that...
I hate to interrupt you, Hank, but guess what? We're out of time. Deborah, David, thank you for being with us on So What's Your Story?
You. Well, thank you for having us.
It's great.
And I hope you'll both come back.
Absolutely.
Please.
Yeah.
Now, don't you dare move, because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson tapes. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story. And treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Warren Holloman, and along with Deborah and David and the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
If you decided to donate your birthday to KPFT this year, thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. Select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then add a personalized message so that your friends know how much KPFT means to you.